Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the September 15th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows a relatively plain-looking cream-colored door, partially open. On the front of the door is the Republican elephant symbol, and sitting atop that is a plain red hat, but clearly the MAGA hat. Crowding with each other, trying to get through the door, the partially open door, are Ron DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Nikki Haley. They're tussling with each other, trying to get into the room. And the headline is, "Too Late? How Republican Alternatives to Trump Are Trying to Open Up the Race." I believe we get that article on the Talking Points page, but we will start with a couple of short main stories. First up, Hurricane Idalia batters the southeast. What happened? Hurricane Idalia barreled across Florida and Georgia this week, turning streets into rivers and ripping off rooftops on its way back out to sea. Idalia made landfall as a Category 3 storm at Big Bend, where the Florida Panhandle meets the peninsula, bringing with it 125-mile-per-hour winds and an 8-foot storm surge. Tampa and St. Petersburg saw near-record floods, while the ocean essentially washed right over the island town of Cedar Key. "My family has been here for many generations," said Cedar Key Mayor Heath Davis. "This storm is worse than we've ever seen." As the hurricane, which slowed down to a Category 1, moved northeast, floodwaters up to 5 feet deep submerged homes, while strong winds toppled trees and power lines, leaving more than 430,000 people without electricity. At least two people died in separate rain-related car crashes, and rescue workers fanned out across both states searching for those stranded in flooded homes. Officials said nearly 1,000 bridges will need to be inspected for storm damage. Another hurricane, Franklin, was also active out in the Atlantic, producing life-threatening rip currents and intensifying Idalia's storm surge on the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. The flooding was made even worse by this week's supermoon, a full moon that exerts a stronger-than-usual gravitational pull and causes higher tides. President Biden said he had spoken with the governors of all three states and promised whatever federal aid was required. "I don't think anybody can deny the impact of the climate crisis now," Biden said. What the columnist said: "In an age of sophisticated weather modeling, it feels like Idalia snuck up on us," said Jeva Long in Heat Map. "Exacerbated by climate change, average sea surface temperatures approached 90 degrees in the Gulf of Mexico ahead of the storm. These unusually warm waters turbocharged Idalia through a process called rapid intensification, in which wind speeds can accelerate by 35 miles per hour in a single day. Climate change may not make hurricanes more frequent, but it does create the conditions for storms that are more intense, slow, and destructive." "We often speak of hurricanes in terms of the physical damage they cause," said Charles Passy in Market Watch, "but they also take a toll on resident psyches, and the stress they inflict may threaten Florida's popularity. The state has the country's third largest population, thanks to its reputation as an income tax-free paradise with a Jimmy Buffett-style leave-your-cares-behind vibe. But as a warming world delivers ever more frightening storms, one wonders if Florida will be able to maintain that growth." All eyes will be on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the next few weeks, said Steve Contorno in CNN.com. DeSantis, who is challenging Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination, has often invoked his response to last year's Hurricane Ian in his pitch to voters. Primary voters are watching his response to Idalia to see whether he can lead through difficult moments and comfort the aggrieved, and crucially, lay the groundwork for rebuilding. A racist shooting spree in Jacksonville. What happened? The Justice Department opened a hate crimes investigation this week after a white gunman using a swastika-adorned rifle shot dead three black people at a Dollar General in Jacksonville, Florida. Ryan Palmiter, 21, fatally shot Angela Michelle Carr, 52, as she sat in her car outside the store before entering the building and killing Al LaGuerre Jr., a 19-year-old Dollar General employee, and Gerald Gallion, 29. Palmiter then texted his father and told him to go into his room, where he found a suicide note and 20 pages of racist writings. The suspect's family called police. Palmiter was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound when officers arrived at the store. Before the attack, the gunman stopped in the parking lot of a historically black Edward Waters University. He fled after being confronted by campus security. He targeted a certain group of people, and that's black people, said Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters. He hated blacks. Palmiter bought his AR-15-style rifle and a handgun legally this year, despite having been placed under a 72-hour psychiatric hold in 2017 for threatening suicide. Under Florida law, such incidents do not appear in background checks unless the person is subsequently committed. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called the gunman a major league scumbag at a Jacksonville vigil, adding, "We are not going to let people be targeted based on their race." The crowd booed DeSantis, who has sought to curb discussion of racism in public schools and colleges, and a subsequent speaker responded to his remarks. "Respectfully, Governor, he was not a scumbag," said local pastor Jeffrey Rumlin. "He was a racist." What the columnist said. Authorities in Jacksonville claim the shooter was a lone wolf, said Juliet Kayem in The Atlantic. But white supremacists do not act in isolation. They are fueled by an online ecosystem of far-right chat rooms where angry young men study, glorify, and seek to replicate past racist mass killings. In Norway, New Zealand, Texas, like foreign terror groups, they use violence to publicize their message that whites are still in charge and willing to kill to prove it. DeSantis said the right things in the wake of the shooting, said the Miami Herald in an editorial. Yet the governor's words ring hollow after 2 years of pushing white grievance politics. He has demonized an AP Black Studies course, scared parents about critical race theory, and painted diversity, equity, and inclusion as anti-American. DEI, CRT, and the woke teaching of systemic racism don't kill people. White supremacy does, as it did in mass murders in Jacksonville, Buffalo, Charleston, El Paso, and Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, the carnage continues, said Nicole Naria in Vox. So far this year, America has suffered at least 476 mass shootings, a term defined as attacks in which four or more people are killed, so Jacksonville is not included. Our gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Our gun suicide rate nearly 12 times higher. With guns present in 45% of U.S. households and a vocal Republican minority opposed to common-sense firearms regulations, including universal background checks, there's no telling how many more people will die. Controversy of the week, Prigozhin, how his killing will affect Putin's grip on power. The video of Yevgeny Prigozhin's private jet tumbling from a summer sky like a shot bird was viscerally shocking, said The Guardian in an editorial. But his death last week may be the least surprising event in modern Russian history. The plane crash near Moscow, probably the result of a bomb or sabotage, came 2 months after Prigozhin, the thuggish leader of the mercenary Wagner group that spearheaded the Battle of Bakhmut, staged a mutiny and led a column of tanks and soldiers toward Moscow, before suddenly accepting Vladimir Putin's offer of a truce, a pardon, and safe harbor in Belarus. Putin, of course, is denying he assassinated Prigozhin, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The Russian autocrat offered sincere condolences to the families of those killed last week, including 6 other Wagner leaders and 3 flight crew, while faint praising Prigozhin as a talented man with a complex fate who made serious mistakes. But while Russian authorities make a show of investigating the crash, Prigozhin's cause of death couldn't be more obvious if he had been shot by a firing squad in Red Square. By exacting bloody revenge for his rebellion, Putin has now reasserted his stranglehold on power. Putin has cleared the stage of an impudent rival, said David Ignatius, also in the Post. But his aura of political mastery has been tarnished, perhaps irreparably. The two months it took Putin to kill Prigozhin after a near coup suggest indecision, and will not erase the Wagner chief's very public critique that the Ukraine war was based on a lie and wasn't worth the terrible cost the nation was paying in blood and treasure. The assassination also further undermines the notion that Russia is a regular state, said The Economist in an editorial. A nation Putin vowed to restore to its great global power has been exposed as a mafia-like enterprise driven by personal whim and blood feuds. From Putin's perspective, there's no contradiction, said Alexander Bonov in Bloomberg. The killing of disloyal associates is a tradition dating back to Joseph Stalin, whom a growing number of Russians regard with respect and even adoration. The brazenness of Prigozhin's murder may be a sign that Putin, a former KGB officer, is ready to give up the democratic window dressing and rule with a Stalin-like iron fist. It's telling that Prigozhin didn't fall out of a window or get poisoned like so many of Putin's foes, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. The choice to murder him in such a spectacular fashion, along with 9 other people, was Putin's bloody homage to his ruthless KGB and Soviet roots. For other members of Putin's inner circle of oligarchs and elites, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic, the assassination is a reminder that they, too, could be eliminated by their paranoid czar at any time. Some may try to flee overseas, rather than wait passively for violence to consume them, but others, especially those who have enough wealth to hire armed bodyguards and private armies, may decide to strike first. Putin could also face revenge from Wagner fighters or the ultra-nationalists for whom Prigozhin was an icon, said Yulia Latinina in The Hill. Prigozhin's demise leaves potential challengers with 2 lessons. 1, Putin's promises are worthless. 2, if your tanks are 120 miles from the Kremlin, don't stop. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for golfing. After former President Donald Trump self-reported his weight as 215 pounds while surrendering to authorities in Fulton County, Georgia. This is down 24 pounds from 2018, when his White House physician claimed the 6'3" Trump weighed 239 pounds, coincidentally just 1 pound shy of technical obesity. It was a good week for smiles after Japanese scientists announced they will conduct clinical trials for a pioneering drug that can regrow human teeth, which one researcher calls every dentist's dream. It was a good week for Hans Niemann, a U.S. chess grandmaster accused of cheating, after the website chess.com lifted its ban on his participation and world champion Magnus Carlsen agreed to play him. Some speculated Niemann was using vibrating anal beads to get messages. But it was a bad week for getting dirty. After 112 participants in a Tough Mudder obstacle race in California contracted infections whose symptoms include fever, muscle pain, and boils. Anywhere on my body that touched the ground had red spots, said participant Chris Palokos. It was a bad week for endorsements. After convicted felon O.J. Simpson announced that he's very impressed thus far by GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy. This guy's on to something, said Simpson, 76. It was a bad week for neurotics, who would fare poorly as members of a human settlement on Mars, according to a new computer simulation. Those who were insecure, inflexible, and unable to cope with boredom and change not only kept the colony from thriving, but also tended to die at a much higher rate. The briefing this week is titled Capturing Carbon. The U.S. is investing in technologies that keep CO2 out of industrial emissions or that remove it from the atmosphere. What is carbon capture? With greenhouse gas emissions continuing to rise, politicians and scientists are looking at capturing carbon dioxide as a potential solution to help reach net zero emissions. The Biden administration just announced a $1.2 billion investment in two carbon capture projects in Texas and Louisiana, its first major investment in the burgeoning carbon removal industry. Carbon capture aims to trap the CO2 released by power plants and factories and keep it from reaching the atmosphere, either by sequestering it underground or recycling it in the plants. For most of human history, nature has provided its own form of carbon capture. Trees absorb carbon dioxide through the process of photosynthesis, but human civilization is now producing far more CO2 than trees can handle. Is carbon capture new? The idea has been around since at least the 1980s, but it's not yet done on a large scale. That would require a steep rise in government funding. A recent report found that carbon removal technologies would need to increase by a factor of 1,300 by 2050 to limit global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The Paris Climate Agreement's increasingly unlikely target is 1.5 degrees. No matter how fast we decarbonize the nation's economy, we must tackle the legacy pollution already in our atmosphere to avoid the worst effects of climate change, said Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. How does it work? There are two types of carbon capture, post-combustion and direct air. The former is the primary method currently used in the U.S. It takes emissions from smokestacks at power plants and factories and separates out the CO2. Direct air capture instead uses a machine that sucks in vast amounts of air like a vacuum and then extracts the carbon with chemicals. The CO2 then gets pressurized into liquid form and transported by pipelines to be used or stored. It can go toward commercial purposes, carbonating drinks, for example, or get recycled back into the energy industry. If sequestered, the carbon is injected into a dense rock layer at least 2,600 feet below ground so that the CO2 doesn't leak out. Is the process expensive? Very. Direct air capture is currently too expensive and energy intensive to work on a large scale. There are only 18 direct air capture plants currently operating in the world. But the Biden administration plans to invest $3.5 billion in direct air capture hubs. The World Resources Institute estimates that direct air capture costs from $250 to $600 per metric ton of CO2. But even at $100 per metric ton, it would cost about $780 billion to lower the atmospheric concentration of CO2 by just one part per million. The atmosphere CO2 concentration is now about 420 parts per million, well past 350, the level at which scientists think we can hold global average temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So major technological breakthroughs are needed for carbon capture to become a truly useful tool. Scientists at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory recently discovered a new technique for capturing the carbon produced in power plants that cost only $39 per metric ton, the cheapest ever reported in a peer-reviewed journal. What are the downsides? Some scientists and environmentalists argue that carbon capture may distract from the goal of reducing emissions and offers an out to energy companies that want to continue burning fossil fuels. Oil and gas companies actually lobbied for carbon capture funding to be included in the 2021 infrastructure bill. Plus, the carbon capture process itself produces emissions. A 2019 study found that widespread carbon capture would lower Earth's net emissions by only 10 to 11% once the energy used to capture the carbon was taken into account. There are also environmental and safety risks that come with building new pipelines to transport CO2. If you're doing too little on the emissions mitigation side, said Glenn Peters of Norway's Center for International Climate Research, then there is no point of carbon dioxide removal. So why do it? Most scientists agree that reaching a safe level of carbon in the atmosphere will be incredibly difficult without using carbon capture. Transitioning to renewable energy sources alone may not be enough. The two projects funded by Biden's investment are expected to capture more than 2 million metric tons of CO2 annually, equal to eliminating almost 500,000 gas cars. The International Energy Agency says that carbon capture could eventually lower global CO2 emissions by almost a fifth and decrease the overall cost of minimizing climate change by 70%. There is no 100% solution, said Howard Herzog of Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Energy Initiative. We need a lot of 120% solutions, and this is one of them. Before we move into the best columns of the week, I wanted to take a moment and read to you the editor's letter. This is from Editor-in-Chief William Falk, who has been at the helm of this magazine that we so enjoy for many years. It's a farewell note from him. When I first began writing in this little box, the September 11th attacks were 5 months away. The spring and summer of 2001 were an idyll before a great storm. There was speculation that we'd reached the end of history with the Cold War receding, peace prevailing, and Western democracy triumphant. The internet and cell phones were just starting to transform our lives. The past 22 years have been a tumultuous, wondrous, and terrible time in our history. And serving as the week's editor-in-chief has given me the great privilege of trying in these pages to help readers and myself make some sense of it all. After 1,148 issues, I have decided to step down and turn the magazine over to the skillful stewardship of executive editor Thanis Bates, who will be fully who will be ably assisted by managing editor Susan Caskey and our other fine writers and editors. I am not retiring and will continue as editor-at-large here while pursuing some other long-postponed writing and editing ambitions. Endings are also beginnings. I am deeply grateful to my current and past colleagues at The Week who've worked so hard and skillfully to make this magazine successful. I also owe a great debt to you, the readers, whose enthusiasm, loyalty, and feedback have fueled me through many long days and helped put my daughters through college. Producing a weekly magazine is a relentless challenge. I have often compared our jobs to the mythic labors of Sisyphus, who was sentenced by the angry gods to roll an enormous boulder up a hill, only to see it roll back down, and to start rolling his burden up again, perpetually. In a compelling essay, the French existentialist Albert Camus argued that Sisyphus' defiant embrace of his face transformed his labors into a source of meaning and even joy. One must imagine Sisyphus happy, Camus concluded. As I leave the boulder in good hands, I am happy. Thank you, friends. See you somewhere down the road. And thank you, William Falk. And we move into a couple of the best columns from the U.S. Christians who love to hate. Christianity is being distorted into a justification for hatred and violence, said David French, the man who shot and killed California shop owner Laura Ann Carlton last month for displaying rainbow pride flag, frequently reposted online messages about calling on Jesus when your heart is hurting and the tears fall. He mixed his messages about Christianity with images of burning pride flags and denunciations of LGBTQ people as literally demonic. As an evangelical Christian, I found this juxtaposition chilling, especially because I hear the shooter's hatred of LGBTQ people from white right-wing Christians all the time. In the Trump era, many evangelicals have embraced a form of political Christianity that bears little resemblance to the faith as described in the Bible. This religiously flavored authoritarianism focuses on attacking external enemies and celebrates threats and violence. The teachings of the New Testament and Jesus were clear. Beware the hateful, the people drawn to strife. Embrace those who are kind and peaceful. Love our neighbors as we love ourselves. But American political Christianity is angry and punitive and positively delights in strife. This religious war is pushing our national divide to the boiling point. Legal or not, Hunter's acts were wrong. Hunter Biden's foreign business dealings may not have been technically illegal, said Sarah Chase, but they were profoundly unethical. President Biden apparently disagrees, insisting, "My son's done nothing wrong." That defense may not hold up as the newly appointed special counsel's investigation of Hunter's tax evasion expands and stretches into the election year. Hunter joined the board of directors of Ukrainian energy company Burisma in 2014, when Vice President Joe Biden had just taken on the task for the Obama administration of pressing Ukraine to tackle its endemic corruption. Devin Archer, Hunter's business partner, told Congress that Hunter brought Joe to dinners or put him on speakerphone with shady foreign business associates. Asked if Hunter offered influence over U.S. policy, Archer said, "He would not be so overt. It's pretty obvious if you're the son of a vice president." Now, there's absolutely no evidence that Joe Biden made any policy decision to help Hunter's partners, but it's not plausible he didn't know about his son's highly lucrative influence-peddling schemes. The president's unconditional public support for everything his son has done serves to sanitize and reinforce that pervasive brand of corruption. Moving on to the last word, our feature article. Interesting title this week. I'm just here for the violence. In the sport of Buhurt, medieval-style armored combat, competitors go at each other with deadly weapons, said David Kelly in the Los Angeles Times. It's brutal, fast, and satisfying. Loveland, Colorado. Pinned against a wooden rail, battered with axes, the knight staggered. Two attackers, clad in armor from head to toe, tried to kick his legs out from under him. There was a flash of steel, and out of nowhere, 280 pounds of man and metal smashed into the surprised assailants, collapsing them in a clanking heap. The audience howled. This is the world of modern medieval battle, a human demolition derby in which men and women wearing up to 100 pounds of armor slash and hammer one another with blunted steel swords, axes, and maces until someone goes down, gives up, or loses on points. Think of it as a car wreck that goes on for 90 seconds, said David Arditi, a member of the Dallas Warlords team, or a meat grinder, fellow fighter Vince Verheiden offered. Yeah, that's the word, Arditi said, meat grinder. The next team marched into the arena for another five-on-five melee. The marshal or referee yelled, fight! And they charged, hacking with axes and swords. Shields collided with helmets. Pole axes, long poles topped with axe heads, thundered down on shoulders with loud clangs, muffled thuds, and sharp thwacks. A few fighters dropped immediately. A couple were thrown to the ground. It ended quickly. Cheering his teammates from the sidelines, then embracing them with his massive arms in praise, I could kiss you. Red-bearded Ian Webb waited for his match. The 6'7", 300-pound member of the Colorado Wardens is a formidable opponent with an axe or sword, a WMD, weapon of medieval destruction, and he was looking for a fight. This is not role-playing or reenactment. The armored combat sport of Buhurt, B-U-H-U-R-T, from an old French word meaning to wallop, delivers adrenaline and raw violence that easily surpasses the bashing found in hockey and football. The weapons are blunt, the pain often sharp. Buhurt developed in the 13th century as a way for knights in feudal Europe to hone their combat skills while putting on a public spectacle. The sport, kept alive in Russia and Ukraine, underwent a resurgence in the 1990s. The first Battle of the Nations was held in Ukraine in 2010, sparking global interest. Governing bodies such as the International Medieval Combat Federation set rules for the fighters. No stabbing, no chopping the back of necks, no hitting feet, no striking behind the knees, no groin shots. Similar to the 13th century, but with 21st century nods to safety, like helmet padding to decrease concussions, and medical care that relies more on physicians than barbers. Most rounds, whether in group battles called melees or one-on-one duels, usually last only a minute or so. Melees can range from bouts of 2 versus 2 up to 150 versus 150, where scads of knights engage in brutal battles that, to the untrained eye, resemble attempted murder or at least assault and battery. Once you learn to trust your armor, a whole new world of possibilities opens up, says Garrett Skovgaard of the Colorado Wardens. If 3 points of contact touch the ground in a melee, the fighter is out. The team with the last knight standing wins the round. Duels are won by the number of strikes on an opponent. Each strike is a point. The winner takes the best of 3 rounds. Over the past few years, new teams have emerged across the U.S. with diverse memberships. There are Pacific Islander, Asian American, Arab American, and Latino fighters. There are all women's teams and teams such as the Knights of Wakanda, a group of black fighters across the country who come together for tournaments. Fighters say interest has been driven by the popularity of the night battles on social media channels such as YouTube, fantasies like Game of Thrones, pent-up energy from the COVID-19 pandemic, and a hunger for ever more full-body contact sports. Two common threads run through those who do this sport. You have a combat sports background, or you're a nerd into Dungeons and Dragons, said Spence Fashing, 51, captain of Minnesota's Twin Cities Wyverns, who were fighting at the Colorado event. I have been a nerd and a jock my whole life, so this scratches both itches for me. Some participants acknowledge a different motivation. I'm just here for the violence, said Blade Pool. His real name, he said, of the Corpus Christi Rust Knights, a 20-year-old blacksmith's son who drove about 17 hours from Texas for the tournament. Armor, which can cost between $1,500 and $15,000, protects against most injuries, but not all. A weapon can sometimes find a small gap. A loose chin strap can send a helmet crashing into the nose or teeth. And illegal strikes can be crippling. During a 2016 fight, Simon Rorich, a pioneer of the sport in the U.S., was hit in the head with an axe just as his helmet fell off. A nickel-sized piece of his skull was driven a few millimeters into his brain. That nearly catastrophic failure gave birth to the Simon strap. Rorich calls it the Me strap, which better secures helmets to fighters. Rorich, 48, made a comeback, earning a reputation as one of the hardest-hitting fighters in the world. A fellow fighter described his strength as almost villainly. Based in Tempe, Arizona, the 6'1", 280-pounder began fighting in 2012, when there were nearly 30 knights in the U.S. Now he estimates there are roughly 300 active fighters. Internationally, he said there are probably about 3,000. Rorich, a high-tech inventor and entrepreneur, travels the country giving seminars on armored combat he dubs Simonars. I shouldn't say this, but you should swing hard enough at someone that it would kill them if they didn't have armor, he said. This is essentially a baseball bat fight while playing rugby, while wearing 80 pounds of steel, while breathing through a snorkel. He calls his fighting style nerd rage, he says. Inspired, he says, by unresolved issues from a rough childhood in rural North Dakota. Taking the occasional blunt axe to the face helps. You feel alive. You feel exhilarated. It's very therapeutic, he said. Whereas melees bring the crushing violence, duels are more heavy metal ballet with occasional sparks flying from the helmets struck by swords. Fighters have reported a faint burning smell. Sword fighting, said Allie Lee, a dueler on the Colorado Wardens team, brings out primal things I feel a lot of people suppress. We all have problems. The point is to find a healthy outlet for them, and that's why I am here. About 5 years ago, Lee, 33, found herself drawn to weapons training and martial arts. Then she discovered sword fighting. She was so taken with medieval dueling that she sold her nail salon, vehicles, and house and moved in with her partner to start Synergy Sword Arts, a sword fighting school in Colorado Springs. It took over my life, Lee said. She routinely practices duels with male teammates but will find a woman's team if she wants to melee. Dueling one-on-one, oh man, it's a dance to the death, said Lee, who wasn't fighting because medication for a recent injury had sapped her strength. I tell people to first learn your weapon, which is you, and then learn your sword. The recent three-day tournament took place at the Colorado Medieval Festival, which spread over a lush green field lined with vendors selling everything from elf ears to leather-bound books of magic spells. Beer and mead flowed freely. A smiling mermaid flipped her tail and waved from a square pool near a sign warning, "Beware of Siren Song." The tranquility, along with the sounds of Stubby Shillagak's Celtic folk band, was punctured by the roar and crash of battle rising from the roughly 30 by 55 fenced area, called a list, on the edge of the field. Between rounds of mostly 5-on-5 and 10-on-10 melees, fighters staggered into a tent for quick breaks. "I'm bleeding. Someone help me get this helmet off," said Colorado Warden Paxton Smith, 25, who sustained a large cut above his eye. Helmets, which can weigh 16 pounds, provide critical protection. The trade-off is that many offer a narrow window on the world, maybe an inch high. Fighters struggle to see what's coming at them, and they speak darkly of helmet horrors when they hyperventilate and feel close to suffocation. Support staff circled fighters like pit crews, swiftly removing helmets, repairing buttons and leather straps, and hydrating exhausted knights. A sweaty fighter flipped open his visor. "Water, I need water," he shouted. Webb, the towering Colorado warden, charged through the congested tent. "Someone give me a weapon," he demanded. "I need a weapon." He grabbed an axe lying on a table. "We need five," said Greg Fisher, the warden's captain, calling for the team to get back on the field. Webb huddled with his teammates. "Push them all the way to their rail, then push them over to the other side," he said. "Try to cause a lot of chaos, all right?" Two teams of five rolled out and faced each other. They wore brightly colored outer garments called surcoats over their armor. Each had a different role. Strikers hack at opponents. Checkers run into them and knock them down. Grapplers throw them to the ground. "Fight," the marshal commanded. They advanced warily. Given his height and 400-pound weight and armor, Webb was a big but dangerous target. Two teammates in front tried to fend off attackers while he delivered heavy blows. But Webb was quickly mobbed and battered from every direction. Corpus Christi's blade pool punched him in the face, then kneed him. Webb punched back. Pool swung his axe into Webb's gut. The audience gasped. Ben Splinter of the Wardens rushed headlong into Poole, jamming him up against the fence in a mighty collision of metal on metal. Keegan Kropf of the Wyverns, who has a boxing and wrestling background, leveled opponents with a great falchion, a beefy-edged chopping sword. He advanced on Webb, who bent under the blows. A teammate charged Kropf but was quickly beaten to the ground. That left just Webb facing three opponents. Melees are stopped when it's three or more against one, so the marshal ended the fight, giving the win to the other team. Fisher, a schoolteacher and cross-country coach, observed from the sidelines, impressed by the turnout. He could muster only five people to fight at the festival last year. This time there were nearly 30. "Interest has increased exponentially," he said. "We'd like to start a women's team and maybe an armored combat school." Many of the fighters, engineers, electricians, auditors, software developers, supplement salesmen, military veterans, and machinists bonded during the tournament. Many were tall and stocky, reminiscent of earlier days as high school wrestlers, football players, or boxers. One would bludgeon another with a mace, help him up, and then compliment him on his technique. When a fighter accidentally delivered an illegal hit, he swiftly apologized and took a knee to indicate his mistake. As the tournament ended, the fighters changed up the traditional melee. Rather than clock each other with axes and swords, they belted one another with frying pans, golf clubs, and metal chairs. An homage to professional wrestling. It was all in good clattering fun, showcasing the protective qualities of armor. Afterward, the knights relaxed in the tent. Riding a wave of combat-fueled endorphins they say can last for hours. Webb said he tends to bottle up a week's frustration, then blow it off in melees. "We are all here beating the crap out of each other, and when it's over, you're all friends," he said. "Once you get started, what really hooks you is the community." Violence has a really weird way of bringing people together, added Poole, who walked in carrying a hefty executioner's sword, a favorite. This story was originally published in the Los Angeles Times. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The host who invited us to come on down, Bob Barker, 1923 to 2023. When he stepped down after 18 years as the host of the game show Truth or Consequences in 1975, Bob Barker was recognized by Guinness as television's most durable performer. That was just a warm-up. He shredded that record in his next role, spending 35 years as host of the CBS game show The Price is Right. With his resonant baritone and perpetual tan, the affable host was a daytime TV institution, exhorting generations of contestants to come on down to guess the prices of cars, appliances, and groceries. By his retirement in 2007, Barker had presided over more than 6,500 episodes, won 19 Emmys, and become a master banter. "Can I kiss you?" a woman on the show once asked. "No, I'm working," he deadpanned. "Meet me in the parking lot later." Born in Darrington, Washington, Barker was raised on a South Dakota Indian reservation where his widowed mother taught school, said the Hollywood Reporter. He trained as a Navy fighter pilot and married his high school sweetheart before studying economics at Drury College in Springfield, Missouri. To pay his way, he read news and sports on a local radio station. When the host of an audience participation show failed to show up, Barker filled in and found his calling, working at stations in Florida and L.A. The producer of Truth or Consequences soon heard him on the radio and invited him to audition for television. Barker charmed audiences with his quips and plain-spoken style, said CBSNews.com. Offered the host job on The Price is Right in 1972. He did both shows for 2 years before Price became his focus. In 1996, he impressed a new audience with a memorable scene in Happy Gilmore in which, playing himself, he beat up Adam Sandler's character. In later years, Barker gained national attention for his animal rights activism, said the Washington Post. A vegetarian, he unfailingly closed The Price is Right by asking viewers to spay and neuter their pets. And he quit his gig hosting the Miss USA pageant after 21 years because producers refused to stop giving fur coats as prizes. Trim and fit well into his senior years, he finally retired at 83. TV hosts are like pies, and some people like apple and some cherry, he said in 2009. I'm just very fortunate that they like me well enough to invite me into their homes for 50 years. And we will flip over to the talking points page. We'll pick up with that article depicted in the cover drawing. GOP debate, an elephant in the room. The winner of the first GOP primary debate was a no-show, said Scott Jennings in the Los Angeles Times. Last week's debate left conservatives like me wondering if these eight candidates have any realistic plan to take down former President Trump, who said he has no intention of lowering himself to spar with contenders he leads in polls by 40 points. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis may have stabilized his foundering campaign with prepackaged tough talk about shooting drug smugglers stone cold dead at the border, but he didn't produce the breakout performance he needed to consolidate the non-Trump field. Former Vice President Mike Pence offered an energetic and feisty performance aimed squarely at the Christian conservatives of Iowa, And former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley supplanted a listless Chris Christie as the principal anti-Trump foil on the stage, warning voters that the multiply indicted MAGA king was the most disliked politician in all of America. Biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy was a slick-talking attention hog, leaving viewers either energized or appalled with his insistence that fixing a broken America isn't complicated, guys. The ensemble performance was surreal, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. Trump's rivals mostly dodged questions about the heavy favorite and instead chose to emulate him. Five candidates even wore matching Trump red ties. If the viable alternatives are all Trump cheerleaders, why wouldn't voters just go with a genuine article rather than one of his sycophants? DeSantis epitomizes this problem, said Philip Klein in National Review. Post-debate polls show him and Ramaswamy getting small bumps, but not nearly enough to make Trump sweat. DeSantis came across as way too calculating and cautious. When the candidates were asked if they'd support Trump as the nominee if he's convicted of a crime, six of the eight candidates raised their hands. DeSantis looked around for a few seconds before half raising his hand. When the candidates were asked whether they would oppose future Ukraine aid, DeSantis' hand went up partially. He dodged a question about Pence's role on January 6 and chided the Fox News moderator for asking candidates to take a clear stance on climate change. With such a huge deficit to overcome, DeSantis does not have the luxury to play it safe. Ramaswamy's cocky know-it-all persona pushed the robotic DeSantis into the background, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The 38-year-old Yale Law School grad smugly dismissed climate change as a hoax and said the U.S. should stop sending weapons to Ukraine and promised to dismantle much of the federal government. He came off as an exaggerated version of a familiar type, the callow and condescending nerd who assumes that skill in one field translates to aptitude in all others. So why is this smug political neophyte now enjoying a bizarre surge to third place in GOP polls? As an Indian American, Ramaswamy delights older white conservatives by telling them the only remaining racism in America comes from the left. Sadly, my party has now adopted a culture that rewards and incentivizes Trumpian behavior, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Candidates who get noticed have no sense of shame. Traits like decency, merit, and consistency become liabilities. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson is too decent, read boring, to win, but the cocky and fast-talking Ramaswamy is perfectly suited to thrive. Haley was an exception, said Noah Rothman in National Review, making the genuinely courageous decision to treat Republican debate watchers like adults. She advocated finding a national consensus on abortion, noting that Republicans will never achieve a filibuster-proof Senate majority to pass a federal abortion ban. She criticized Trump administration spending that added $8 trillion to the national debt, and vigorously defended U.S. support for Ukraine and condemned Vladimir Putin as a thug and a murderer. Finally, she warned Republicans that Trump is going to spend more time in a courtroom next year than he is campaigning, weakening his chances of beating the incumbent Joe Biden. But it remains to be seen whether there is a market for sanity and realism in today's GOP. I doubt it, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. The GOP has mutated from a political party into an angry, unfocused, sometimes violent countercultural movement. Members signal tribal solidarity by hating whatever progressives and Reagan conservatives like me support. Ukraine? To hell with them. Government agencies? Disband them. Donald Trump? Pardon him. With a few exceptions, the debate was an exercise in moral cowardice. But it probably doesn't matter. it seems increasingly inevitable that Trump will be the GOP nominee, and none of the people at the debate in Milwaukee had a clue what to do about that. On the poll watch, we have 77% of Americans say that Joe Biden, 80, is too old to effectively serve another 4 years as president, including 69% of Democrats and 89% of Republicans. 51% of Americans think that the 77-year-old Donald Trump is too old to serve another term, including 71% of Democrats and 28% of Republicans. We've got time for two quotes. One from Nikita Khrushchev says, "Politicians are the same all over. They promise to build bridges even when there is no river." And the actor-comedian Bill Murray says, "Whatever you do, always give 100%, unless you're donating blood." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.